rather than being struck dead. A familiar blue glow leaped from the hilt and hummed to life, forming its lethal shape. My blade is still active. And if his sword functioned, then it meant their other weapons would too. This is where you're wrong, Dural told the shaken warrior. If all major power sources are down in this region, it is not a disaster at all. Not for us. It is an opportunity.
Chapter 23. Not long after the teachers brought all of the students back inside the school, a series of violent explosions thundered in the air. Clearly the UNSC had launched some kind of counterattack, but to what extent remained a mystery. The distant thrumming of weapons fire continued uninterrupted for a minute before one final deep alien-sounding boom. Then the power in the school went out completely. To Molly's surprise, the surge that cut the power didn't just affect the school, but everything inside it too. The lights went out, their data pads all died, and nothing electronic worked at all. Whatever it was, killed the power in everything they had. Seconds later came another series of explosions. These sounded the closest, shaking the ground with the force of an earthquake, the last one blowing out several windows in the dining hall. Curious, Molly ignored the teacher's orders to stay away from the windows and ran to one that had shattered, finally getting a chance to look outside. Across the outskirts of the school grounds and in the less populated region just before the first barrier sprawled the smoking debris of at least two UNSC frigates. Looking to their left, Molly caught a glimpse of yet another ship nosediving into the ground with a mighty crash that shook the entire school. Ash and dust whipped across the ground in strong gales, obscuring the destruction for a moment before dying down. Turning back from the window, Molly realized that the power inside was still out. Most of her fellow students gaped back at her with wide eyes, probably thinking she had a death wish. She'd been through blackouts before, mostly back in Wisconsin during one of the big storms there. While those blackouts may have taken out the power, they hadn't also drained the energy out of every battery. She hadn't thought that was possible. Something incredibly strange was going on. The Guardian had to be behind it. They were fortunate that this had happened in the middle of the day. Otherwise, they'd have been plunged into darkness. She peeked outside once more to see the debris from the crashed UNSC warships strewn across the ground in the distance, with large gouts of flame stabbing out of them. In the sky above, the Guardian seemed to remain untouched and continued to surge with power. It was the only thing still active. Dinaka Crowley, the Sangheili teacher who'd stopped Carl, Zeb, and Andre from bullying Molly and the others the first day, pressed through the crowd of students along with Afrid and a handful of other teachers. They came and stood by Molly, peering out through the windows at the destruction. The fight had only lasted for a few seconds, and the UNSC had lost. Real people had been on those ships, probably including parents of some of Molly's fellow students, and the Guardian had effortlessly killed them all. Kasha Hylot arrived moments later and began grouping students and teachers together, making each adult responsible for a handful of tables. Molly and her friends wound up with Dinok watching over them and two tables of Sangheili. She was disappointed when Dinok made her leave the window and sit down at a table. But she'd already seen everything outside there was to witness. At least for now. Until we figure out exactly what's happening out there, we are going to remain on full lockdown, Kasha said, once the teachers had gathered their groups of students. All communications are currently down, but I have sent a runner to communicate with Director Mendez. Until we hear back from him, our established protocol is to stay put. Carl's hand shot up, and Kasha acknowledged him with a nod of her head. Why can't we just go home? Some of us live close by. The safest place for us all is right here, Kasha said, We don't want the security force to have to worry about hundreds of children running loose across Paxopolis while they try to respond to this situation, whatever it might be. And your parents know that you're safe with us as part of our existing protocol. Well, I think I'd personally feel safer at home. The students at Carl's table laughed nervously at that. Why don't we take a vote on it? Kasha folded her arms over her chest and leveled a solemn stare at him. You're mistaking this school for a democracy, and yourself for an adult. Carl opened his mouth to protest, but she cut him off. We have enough reserves of food and water for us to hold out for some time, should we need to, although I very much doubt it will come to that. With luck, we will resolve this shortly, and have you all on your way home soon. She ended the conversation with a sharp bob of her long neck and left the dining hall. Once she was gone, the room erupted into conversation again, although this time, the students kept it to a dull roar. After several minutes, Dinnock leaned over Molly's table and glanced at each student in turn. You seem like a good bunch of fledglings. Could you mind yourselves if I took a quick walk in the yard to assess the situation? Kadam lit up at that idea. Will you take us with you? I'd love to get a better look at that machine again. Do you think it had anything to do with the blackout? I mean, sure, it had to, right? But what? I don't know of anything that can completely strip the energy from everything, just like that. But whatever did it sure did it well, if you know what I mean. Kareem put a hand on Gadam's arm to steady her, and she finally stopped talking long enough to catch her breath. I'm sorry, she said with a weak smile. I tend to get carried away like that when I'm nervous. No, Dinnock said flatly, in his no-nonsense way. I will not take you with me. But if you remain good until I get back, I will tell you what I see. Fair enough, Kareem said. The rest of the table nodded assent at Dinnock, and he turned and left. What do you all think, Kareem said once they were alone again, about that thing out there, I mean? That thing is called a guardian. Molly was no longer concerned about keeping it a secret. If there was ever a time to be honest with her friends, it was now. How would you know that? Bakar asked. My new parents came here to research one buried on Onyx. Probably this same exact one. Understanding dawned on their faces. I wish my parents had been assigned to something so amazing, Gadam said. Maybe, Molly said, suddenly concerned for Asha and Yong. She wondered where they were. Did they travel out to the Guardian today? Were they near it when it rose from the ground? As you can see, it's not exactly the best kind of amazing. We are doomed, Bakar said. The statement shocked Molly. Not because of what had been said, but because of who had said it. Bakar always seemed so confident and self-assured that she hadn't ever expected to hear such a gloomy prediction come out of his mouth. Seriously? Molly said. Just like that. Did you not see what it did to those ships? To the city? The machine is invincible. He's got a point, Kareem said. You saw the size of that thing. Even if they can get our stuff online again, how could they possibly stop it? It's not hard to do the math, Molly. We don't know that everything's out. Just because our stuff here in the school wasn't shielded from whatever happened, doesn't mean that the security force's weaponry is all shot, too. I mean, if we had the means to protect something against that kind of attack, don't you think they'd use it in Trevelyan rather than the school? Maybe the Guardian only shut everything down because we attacked it, Kareem said. You heard that message last night. Molly shrugged, not ready to concede the point. But Kareem was right. That's what the message had said. And despite that, the first response of the UNSC had been to attack. Molly knew why they had done so. The UNSC was well aware of what the Guardians had been doing across human space, and those soldiers had been trying to prevent the same sort of thing from happening to Onyx. So you think Director Mendez just launched an attack on the Guardian, and what happened was a response? Kadam asked. Director Mendez only presides over the security of Paxopolis. He is not in charge of Trevelyan or the Oni complex, Bakar said. That duty belongs to Director Barton. Either way, they did what they thought was best, Molly said. cutting off the speculation. I really hope they've got something else up their sleeve, though. There has to be a way to stop that thing. Someone's just got to figure out how. Molly peered back out the window at the plumes of smoke that marked where the ships had gone down, though. And she couldn't help but wonder, if the UNSC can't protect us, who can? Hours later, about the time Pax Institute was normally supposed to let out, Kashaw entered the dining hall to report on the situation. We're still waiting to get an all-clear from Trevelyan to send you home to your parents. At the moment, no power is working anywhere in Trevelyan or Paxopolis, and there's been some damage to the surrounding buildings. However, my runners are still in communication with Director Mendez. He will let us know as soon as it is safe to proceed outside. Since the power outage, the machine has shown no additional signs of hostility. If this situation lasts into the evening, we plan to return you to your homes before dark. Thank you for being model students throughout this trying time. I know we are all unsure of what might happen next, but if we work together and treat each other with respect, it will prove to be a testament to Paxopolis and its ideals. Under most other circumstances, a good portion of Molly's class would have groaned at Kashaw Hylot's announcement, but the students were all too stunned by the day's events to complain. Everything they would normally argue about seemed petty against the Guardian's arrival and what had taken place outside. Looking around the room, Molly realized that Dinnock had come back, but he hadn't bothered to check in with their table. "He's mostly watching over those two tables of Sangheili," Molly said to the others in a hushed voice. "What's that about?" "Those are some of the most aggressive Sangheili in the school," Bakar said with a shrug. "He is making sure they do not do anything foolish. Sangheili males are not used to spending a lot of time pent up in one place. We are trained for active physical engagement from a very young age. Sitting still does not come easy, especially when there is a fight brewing. That is why many Sangheili become warriors." "Is that what you're going to do when you're old enough?" Molly asked, though she felt she could already guess the answer. "Become a soldier?" Bakar looked at her. "No, I am not like them." "But that is your plan, is it not?" Molly's jaw dropped. She hadn't told anyone at the school about her interest in joining the UNSC. "It's in your bearing," Bakar said in a knowing tone. "Your attitude." "And what about Kareem?" Molly asked, trying to change the subject. "Do you see it in him?" Bakar stared blankly in Kareem's direction. "I'm more of a fly-over-the-battlefield kind of guy myself," Kareem offered. "So you know how to pilot?" Molly asked, surprised. Kareem blushed a bit at that. "Let's just say, I've put in a lot of hours with simulation." "I wasn't aware we had access to a flight simulator," Molly said. "I thought it was only for military personnel." "As long as you have special approval, it's open to almost anyone," Kareem said. "His dad was a pilot," Kadan said softly. A cloud passed over Kareem's face. "Ah," Molly said. "I'm sorry." Kareem immediately ginned up a game smile. "The war's been over for a long time. My dad's been gone even longer. And we have other things to worry about." He nodded in the direction of the Guardian. "Wonder if they'd let us go outside and look at it," Molly said. "Probably say it was too dangerous, right?" "Perhaps we should not ask." Bakar pressed his mandibles together shrewdly. That surprised Molly. Bakar always seemed so straight-laced. "It is simpler to wipe off your blade once it has been blooded," the Sangheili said. "What?" Molly didn't get the idiom. "You do not ask if you can strike. You simply strike." "Are you trying to say it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission?" He looked unimpressed. "Close enough." Sangheili probably did little asking for forgiveness, Molly thought, and even less asking for permission. We can't have been the first students to have thought of this, Karim said, glancing around.
That's a good point, Gadan said. Of course, if everyone else here had come up with the same idea before us, the dining hall would be empty now, right? Or maybe they all thought better of it, which is why none of them have dared to try to leave.
She glanced around the room.
That actually makes much more sense to me, I think.
We could just slip out into the recreation yard, Karim said. Everyone would see us open the doors, Bakar pointed out.
Maybe we could go through the science hall.
Molly pointed toward a corridor that led down an alternate path to the yard. The others liked that idea. When the four of them saw their chance to make a break for it, they all quickly hustled out of the hall and down the corridor, padding along as quietly as they could. They eventually made it to the doors that led into the auditorium, and from there they could reach the yard.
Where to next? Molly asked. Are we sure we want to go to the yard and risk having someone spot us from the dining hall?
Let us go to the roof, then. The Sangheili pointed toward a nearby door across the hall from the auditorium. There is a set of stairs in there that leads to an access hatch on the top of the school. From there, we can easily see what kind of damage the machine has done. The door to the stairwell was unlocked, and they took the stairs all the way up to the top. Fortunately, the stairwell was lined with windows, letting in plenty of sunlight for them to see. When they reached the top landing, they found a ladder that led to a steel hatch above them. Karim went first and reported it was unlocked. He shoved it open and climbed up and through, briefly looking around before beckoning the rest of them to follow. Gadam went next, with Bakar right behind her. When she struggled to climb over the hatch's edge, Bakar gave her a boost through. Then Molly came up last and didn't bother to shut the hatch behind her. She was too stunned by what she saw. The guardian stood alone on the horizon opposite of where it had first appeared, hovering over the squat square buildings of Trevelyan that sat near the aperture. There was no sign of the UNSC, or of anything else. Only silence. Silence and smudges of smoke marring the otherwise pristine sky. From this vantage, they could see multiple crash sites around the city. Some of the impacts had been huge, where UNSC starships had suddenly lost power and smashed into the ground. Thankfully, their fusion drives had not exploded, or little of Paxopolis would have remained intact. Other pockets of debris appeared to be composed from the wreckage of smaller craft, such as fighters or even gunships. Some had crashed into the ground, others into buildings. Molly wondered how many lives had been lost today. Had hundreds of people been on those frigates? And how many had been in the buildings below that had been struck, some of which had toppled over into piles of rubble? Molly followed the others over to the edge of the roof and leaned up against the parapet. From there, she could hear the distant chatter of gunfire and the humming reports of energy weapons, and she could see bright flashes from both on the outskirts of the city.
What's happening? Gadam said as she tried to peer over the wall. Who's fighting out there?
Molly recognized the sounds of the UNSC's armaments. Most of that is coming from humans, but not the energy blasts. Maybe they're Sangheili?
Those do not sound like the plasma weapons of my people, Bakar said.
Molly wasn't so sure.
She noticed shadows swiftly crossing the street and darting into an alley, almost half a click away. Too far away to see clearly. She leaned forward and stared, trying to discern what must have been a distant battle, given the bright flashes of light against the spires of smoke. If they hadn't been on top of the school, they wouldn't have been able to see anything at all. This vantage was as good as it was going to get.
Molly strained her eyes harder.
Who is the UNSC fighting?
Against the splash of weapons fire, she saw strange shapes come into focus. Although they were bipeds, they did not look or move like humans, or Sangheili either. Covered in a strange metal-like armor and firing what appeared to be Forerunner energy weapons, these bizarre soldiers surged through the streets like choreographed dancers, moving in well-coordinated patterns. They also glowed bright orange in places, and seemed to move in fierce, quick bursts,
as if they were teleporting from one place to the next, though from that distance, it was impossible to tell for sure.
"This is worse than I thought," Kareem said.
"But at least those things aren't in the halls of our school."
"Not yet," Molly said.
Chapter 24 One of the first things the Fieldmaster taught the Pale Blade was, never attack your opponent's strength. Duralum Dama knew from his short time in command that many warriors forgot this when they sized up a foe. They saw the point at which their enemy was strongest, and they attacked that, often because it was the most noticeable thing and made the biggest target. This is the path to destruction, and the imprudent charge down it because they want to prove themselves the strongest on every level. They want not just to defeat their foes, but to humiliate them and dance on their corpses. So Avu Med Telkam would say. While Dural could appreciate the impulse to shame an enemy, he recognized the foolishness. He knew that the only thing that counted in a battle was winning. History did not celebrate those who lost, and victory was never enjoyed by the dead. So, when Rook suggested that they charge headlong for the security checkpoints on the edge of the human territory and attack in a frontal assault, Duro had to fight two impulses. The first was to strike Rook across the face with the butt of his storm rifle for making such a ridiculous suggestion. The second was to let him attempt it. Part of leading was to allow the overly ambitious to be crushed on the shoals of their own ambitions. Rook would have probably failed to take down even a single human soldier before they ground him beneath their boots, and it would have served as a lesson to the survivors under Dural's command. But Rook would have insisted on taking many of the warriors with him, and Dural did not care to spill their blood on such insanity. "I am not stupid enough to waste lives attacking our enemies in their castles and citadels, while they sit in gunner's nests," Dural told Rook, as the servants' commanders scrambled to assemble their warriors for a march upon the human city. "But they are engaged in battle with the machines of the Forerunners," Rook said. "Should we not come to the aid of the soldiers of the gods?" Even Kiel had informed Dural and his commanders that the Guardian had deployed Forerunner soldiers, a class of armagers, to contend with the humans attempting to resist it. This certainly complicated Dural's plan, but in his mind, it added the kind of complexity that could be used to the servants' advantage. In making their defense against the Forerunner threat, the humans had exposed their soft underbelly, and Dural would not miss an opportunity to strike it. "They are indeed machines made by the gods. But whether their actions hail from an edict of the gods or their own desires remains to be seen," Dural told Rook. "Have you not learned from our people's time in the Covenant? The machines of the gods sometimes go mad and make their own path, even at the cost of the faithful. Whatever the case, it is too great a risk. I am not charging into a firefight in which both sides might turn against us at once. Give me a portion of our warriors, Pale Blade, and I will take care of the rest," Rook said, checking the power supply on his armor. "This is our chance, the one we've been waiting for, to destroy the humans on this world and to at last wrest control of it."
"And that is exactly what we are going to do," Dural said calmly. "But instead of trying to destroy their strongest concentrations of soldiers, we will do what they least expect, and strike at what means the most to them. Their families and friends."
Rook scoffed at Dural. "And what good will that do? We are at war, and you want to attack them in their keeps? To the humans, this is not a military base, but a research site. Their soldiers are here only to protect the researchers. If we eliminate those non-military personnel, we rip the heart out of their operation. Do you not see? They are occupied at the moment, distracted, so we strike them at their weakest point. When they double over in agony at our success, then, and only then, we sever their heads and take what is rightfully ours.
Rook bristled at Durand's plan. He wanted to plunge his energy sword into a demon's heart. The Pale Blade understood the desire, but the Fieldmaster had placed him in charge to pursue wiser options than simply gratifying his warrior's desire for revenge.
"What about your plan to steal their Hurrigok?" Rook asked. "Has that too been forsaken?"
Dural clacked his mandibles and turned to Rook as if he were a fledgling.
"They use their Hurrigok in their research. Do you think they would have such rare and precious creatures at the edge of their settlement, where you suggested we strike? Or might they be lodged deep inside their city, where there is some measure of safety and protection?"
"Point taken," Rook said grudgingly. "Still, I do not relish slaughtering the feeble in their homes. That is not the way of our people."
"That kind of talk is exactly how we lost the war with the humans," Dural snarled. "And it was why we lost the battle against the Arbiter, too. You ask us to bend like water when we must be nothing but stone."
The solution to the Pale Blade's dilemma over the past few weeks had been in front of him the entire time. He had been thinking about how the servants of the Abiding Truth might accumulate sufficient mass and firepower to contest the humans openly. But there was no need to take that path. The humans had foolishly embedded themselves among the relics of the Forerunners, many of which they used as dwellings. If the servants Hurrigok, even Keel, could manipulate the portal network to get Dural's forces into the city right now, that would change everything. The plan held great risk, but also promised unparalleled rewards. "Instead of throwing ourselves against a fortification," he said to Rook, "we will emerge inside their courts and strike at the very heart of their settlement before they even realize they have been compromised." Content with his defense of the plan, Dural strode off toward Keel, who floated near the controls to the cathedral's portal. "Have you found an active portal that reaches inside the human city yet?" Dural asked. Before Dural had set him to that task, Keel had confirmed that some power sources, such as those in small arms or certain data devices, could be reset, while others remained stubbornly inactive. Vehicles, ships, weapons emplacements, and many larger machines and power grids were kept neutralized by a steady pulse constantly emanating from the ancient construct. Somehow the portals on Onyx could be reactivated, though, as the Forerunners had apparently shielded them from the effects of the Guardian's attack. Even Keel bobbed its head as it displayed the image of an overhead map of their target on a nearby screen. The humans built their settlement in and around the city the Forerunners named the Citadel. Most of the portals inside of it are defunct, but I was able to activate one particular portal that seems well-placed for your purposes. Dural could see how the humans had settled inside the Citadel's abandoned buildings and built in, on, and around them, like uncontrolled weeds that begged for immolation. One spot on the map glowed a bright blue, showing the portal through which even Keel could transport the servants, right into the center of the ancient Forerunner city. "We enter here, and we strike hard," Dural said. "We do everything we can to sow chaos throughout the city. If this distracts them from their battle against the Forerunner soldiers, so much the better. We are all servants of the gods." Dural's frontline commanders, including the recalcitrant Rook, assembled behind him. For this operation, they would travel directly into their target from the cathedral. While it meant the humans might be able to trace their route back to their home base, Dural felt it was well worth the risk. Getting hundreds of warriors to pour into the city through one gate would be enough of a challenge on its own. For Dural's plan to work, the servants needed to move orderly and effectively, and fast, without prematurely drawing attention to themselves. The pale blade gazed into the eyes of the warriors nearest to him. They were all hungry to no longer be forced to sneak around on this shield world. They wanted to marvel up close at the riches their enemies had plundered, while inflicting retribution on those same foes. They wanted to taste a real victory of some sort. And today was finally the day. Dural fixed a storm rifle onto his back and drew his energy sword, activating it. Its blade hummed to life, and he held it high over his head. "For the abiding truth," he shouted, and his warriors responded in kind. "And for Avu Med-Telkam!" Then Dural charged through the activated portal first, and found himself exactly where Keel had promised, atop a sprawling Forerunner structure in the center of the Citadel. His heart leaped at the sight. At that moment, Dural wanted little more than to explore the place and plumb the depths of the mysteries of the gods in their very own dwellings. But there would be time for that later, after rooting out the traitors and the humans once and for all. Dural found himself standing on a wide platform that spread out below him, hedged by a low curving wall. Ramps peeled away to his left and right, descending toward the streets below. It appeared to be a veranda of some sort, perhaps for recreation or watching the nearby lake. A number of humans had gathered by the wall, evidently to watch in relative safety the battle that raged around the city streets, just below the looming guardian. Dural quickly charged into those hapless weaklings before they could signal any kind of threat and call attention to the servants' ingress. They were unarmed and unarmored. Anyone worth the title of soldier had already gone off to fight in the battle, so the Pale Blade saved them the shame of their cowardice by ending their lives. When the attack was over, Dural saw that Rook and his vanguard had joined him. They were finally ready to enact the plan. The rest of Dural's command had already started down the ramps as he had ordered. They were to fan out and find more humans to eliminate. If they discovered anything of interest, they would report to him immediately. Otherwise, their only objective was to kill every enemy in their path, no matter who or what they were, and then rendezvous back there by dusk. It may have been a simple and ruthless plan, but it had a twofold purpose. Dural hoped to cause enough bloodshed to create a major disruption in the humans' ability to research the shield world, and to absolutely crush the morale of their military. The first goal was practical, while the second would hopefully allow the servants to gain the upper hand. When possible, Dural hoped to add a third dimension, but it relied on the humans' weakness. "This is a glorious day for the gods," Rook said. "Are we to join the others?" At least for the moment. Their presence in the heart of the enemy stronghold had washed away all of Rook's doubts about Dural's methods. "No," Dural told him. "I have other plans for this vanguard. For the time, we will let our brothers strike deep into the enemy's position, where they are weakest, while we watch for their mistakes, and then take advantage of them." Dural strode over to the wall and stood where the humans had been when he had first appeared. From there, he had an excellent view of much of the city. The center of it appeared to be entirely of Forerunner design. But toward the edges, he could see where the humans had sprouted their own structures. It was almost as if they had surrounded the Forerunner city and were now trying to absorb it, like an infection inside the shield world. If so, Dural and his servants would prove to be the divine cure the gods had the foresight to bless, so that they might protect the work of their hands. He stared out across the city and the adjacent lake for a long while, watching and listening for signs of progress. Once their presence started to spread throughout the city, it would not take long for the humans to react. Will they call their soldiers back from the assault against the Guardian? Will they attempt to mount some feckless defense of their own? Or will they simply flee? The humans' response would dictate the servants' next steps.
One could gain much knowledge of enemies by their reactions to an attack. They tended to fortify themselves and protect the things they cared about, rather than simply that which was closest to them. If forced, they would even run toward things that they valued most, even at the cost of their own safety. For the most part, the Pale Blades warriors were remarkably efficient. They quickly cut down the humans in the streets and their buildings before they could get too far or raise an alarm. After a while, however, Rook and the rest of Duron's vanguard grew restless. They had clearly started to think that the Pale Blade's seeming caginess might lead to some kind of loss. But that was only because they failed to recognize that victories came when they waited carefully for the enemy to prove foolish. The gods would deliver such triumphs to them, if they were wise enough to be patient. At that very moment, as Rook and the others grumbled behind him, Duron spotted precisely what he was looking for. A lone Hurrigach. It was floating high, well above the reach of anyone on the streets, and it kept itself near the rooftops, out of sight of any of his warriors below. This was the third element of Duron's plan. His failure at the repository had taught him a lesson. On the outskirts of their settlement, the humans were heavily protected and had protocols in place to keep their assets, such as the Hurrigach, safe. Inside the city, however, a site infested with weaklings, the creatures would likely be little more than unguarded pets that could be taken with relative ease, if Duron's forces could infiltrate deep enough. Rook shouted in excitement and tried to dart directly after the Hurrigach, in plain sight. Duron grabbed him by the collar of his armor and hauled him back. "Have you learned nothing, Rook? We cannot just charge after such a creature. It is already fearful. We must be discreet." The Pale Blade was tired of his own commander's failure to trust the gods, and he considered beating some sense into Rook right then and there. But Koenig stayed Duron's hand by drawing Duron's attention back toward the Hurrigach. "It seems to be heading toward the outskirts of the city. We have no time to waste if we wish to corner it." "Then we shall spend no more time here," Duron said to his vanguard. "We move now." Chapter 25. Tom had known many better days, but few as insane. The Forerunner soldiers that had appeared at the same time as the Guardian had hauled its chrome-colored structure out of the ground had all but overrun Trevelyan, taking out not only many of the regular Marines, but a number of the Spartans stationed there alongside him as well. It was all they could do to circle the wagons and try to keep the Armagers from storming right through the city without even stopping to say goodbye. It was one thing to face off against the Armagers, as many of them as there were. They might be tough and deadly, but one could bring them down with regular small arms fire. Maybe a grenade or three. But the Guardian was something else entirely. It was like a giant from the old Earth legends. It treated all the UNSC soldiers inside Onyx the way Tom might treat a cloud of gnats. They were irritating, but nothing that could do any real damage. The damn thing actually loomed over Tom's head on its way toward the center of Trevelyan, and Tom had unloaded a barrage of Hydra rockets into the thing from directly below it. None of them had so much as left a scratch on the Guardian. He'd turned back to taking out Armagers after that. At least they fell down when you put enough slugs into them. When the Pelicans, Kestrels, and Hornets had come screaming overhead, Tom hoped they might be able to finally find a crack in the Guardian's armor. For a few minutes, he'd even allowed himself to hope that they could bring the thing down, although he hated to think about where it might land. Then it pulled that little trick of its to blow out all the lights. Everything went dead, with the notable exception of his Mjolnir armor and that of the other Spartans, and the UNSC aircraft had dropped from the sky. Tom missed Lucy the most at that moment. In one way, he was glad that she'd taken off to investigate a lead in the remote parts of Onyx, if only because it meant she wouldn't have to go through all this. but he'd grown used to having her by his side. They'd survived so many horrible things together. He'd figured they'd always be there for each other whenever the end came. But she wasn't around for this. If he was going to die today, it would be without her. With the comm system down, he couldn't even talk with her to see where she was and how she was doing. She'd taken off in a Pelican long before all this had started, chasing after the servants' ghosts. He could only hope she hadn't had the aircraft in the sky when the Guardian had fired off that pulse. His stomach sank with that thought. Then the servants of the Abiding Truth had finally shown themselves. They'd appeared through a portal that they'd energized in the middle of the city, and they'd started gunning people down left and right. Civilians. Children, even. He and Lucy had discussed this nightmare scenario with Mendez. The servants using the portal system to launch a surprise attack in the heart of Paxopolis. The people there wouldn't be able to do much to defend themselves, and it would be up to the UNSC to rally to their aid straight away. Tom never thought it might happen during a Forerunner attack launched by the appearance of a Guardian. He could barely imagine a worse scenario. "Take them out!" Tom had shouted to every Spartan within range of his voice. He'd thought that with the comm system down, he wouldn't be able to rally a response to the rogue Sangheili threat. But he needn't have worried. At the sight of the armed and armored servants, every soldier around him had headed straight for them. They might not have been able to do much about the Guardian, but they would all be damned if they were going to let the servants of the Abiding Truth run rampant over their friends and family. Tom charged as well, taking on an entire squad of Sangheili on his own, and then another, and another. It had been a while since he'd been able to cut loose like that in a firefight, and it felt good. After he'd run out of immediate targets, he could hear Mendez's voice in the back of his head. "It's easy to think tactically, Spartans. Don't forget to think strategically." As always, the old man had a point. Because they were so good at small group tactics, Spartans tended to focus on that. They often thought, just take down the targets in front of you as they come, and the bigger picture will take care of itself. Mendez had countless times taught Tom the error of that way of thinking. It was a good path to blow your actual mission, not to mention getting yourself killed by foes you didn't see coming. With a director like Mendez online, Tom usually felt that the bigger angles would be covered. All he had to do was follow orders. But with the comm system down, Tom didn't have any command structure to fall back on. He didn't even have any other Spartans around him at the moment. Tom decided that if he wanted strategic intel, he was going to have to hunt it down himself. He found the tallest building nearby and stormed to the top of it, busting through the doorway that led out onto the roof. Once up there, he surveyed the area around him. In the distance, Marines still battled with the armagers clustered beneath the Guardian, which was hovering over the landing pad near the entrance tunnel in the center of Trevelyan. If he sprinted off in that direction right now, he felt sure he wouldn't be able to get there in time to make a difference. By contrast, skirmishes with the servants raged around him on all sides. The Sangheili didn't seem to care whom or what they were fighting. They just wanted to destroy as much as they could and cause as much harm as fast as possible. From his vantage point, Tom could see that the servants had emerged from a portal that fronted a Forerunner spire near the southern end of the Citadel, which lay in the middle of Paxopolis. He could be there in minutes and might be able to help cut the servants off from any means of escape. Unless he managed to gather a force of Spartans and Marines around him as he went, though, they'd probably overwhelm him in the attempt. Even Spartans had their limitations. Then he spotted a Huragok floating low over the tops of the city's roofs, heading in the direction of the Pax Institute. A band of servants, led by a Sangheili dressed in pale armor, chased after the creature. By Tom's estimate, the servants wouldn't catch the Huragok before it reached the school, which meant that the servants would charge in after it. Tom swore as he raced back down to the street. He might not be able to get to the school in time to stop the servants from entering it, but he would be damned if he wasn't going to try.
Chapter 26. Molly, Bakar, Gudam, and Karim were still watching the ground battle below the Guardian unfold, when Prone to Drift found them on top of the school's roof. The Hurragok just casually floated up over the top of the parapet, and then nestled down in the space that the four made as they cleared away from it. The Hurragok seemed agitated, although its electronic voice never wavered in tone. At first, Molly feared that someone had sent it to look for them, or that it was considering whether it should turn them in. But she soon realized that it had absolutely no idea that they'd broken any rules, and Molly wasn't about to correct that. "It is the time of day that I come to the school to help," Prone said through its vocalizer program. "I tapped into the sensors in the school, and they showed that all of the doors into the building are locked. They also showed me some movement on the roof, so I came up here to investigate. Hello." The four of them should have brought Prone downstairs immediately to talk with Kashaw. But they didn't. They had too many questions. "Can you turn the power back on?" Karim asked it before anyone else could get in a word. "Eventually. But it will take time. And if the Guardian is still active, it can undo all my work in an instant." "Can you destroy the Guardian?" Bakar asked. "That is beyond my ability to manage. I might be able to disable it, though, if I was able to get closer." "How close?" Gadam asked, curious. "I would not have to actually touch it, but I would have to be within its magnetic field, and close enough to communicate with its control arrays." "That's probably too close," Molly said. "You would never make it through the battle that's going on beneath it. Is there another way?" Prone squirmed a bit as it thought about the problem. Molly was fond of how it approached everything as an engineering issue. Just another problem to be solved by means of applied science. "I do not know," it finally said. "I lack sufficient information about it." Molly sighed in disappointment, but wasn't about to give up that easily. "You've been here for thousands of years, and there's been a Guardian here probably since Onyx was created. Isn't there a kill switch for situations like these?" "Of course. It was used in the past, which is how it came to be buried here. I did not deactivate the Guardian personally, but one of my ancestors did. I can access their memories to see what took place." "Then do that," Gadam said, still somehow excitedly optimistic. A moment later, Prone stated, "My ancestor says that the Guardian unit inside the shield world was activated for only a short time. It was being used to monitor the building progress. When building stopped, they deactivated the Guardian and sent Shield 006 into slipspace for safety. The Guardian has been dormant ever since." "Until today, it seems," Bakar said as he gazed out at the battle still raging beneath the great construct. Prone to Drift's six-eyed head bobbed up and down. "According to the message received last night, the AI known as Cortana activated the Guardian here to pacify the shield world. She intends to use her power to put an end to war, disease, and hunger, among many other troubles." "That actually doesn't sound so bad," Gadam said. "We had decades of war, right? And it caused all sorts of problems. Mama Afrid told me about this plague that hit her home planet before she was born. Nearly wiped out the entire population. And the hunger! The Ungoy always get fed last, let me tell you." "What's the catch?" Karim said. "The biological intelligences will have to give up all autonomy to the created," Prone to Drift said. "They would control every aspect of their existence. The created claim they need this power over the rest of thinking life, so that they can ensure the safety of the galaxy. Whether this is true or not is arguable. Either way, if we do not give them that control, they propose to take it." "For our own good, I'm sure," Molly said sarcastically. "I have figured out a way to preserve the shield world from that dictate." Prone to Drift began wobbling back and forth in the air. "I just have not determined if I should use it." "Why?" Molly asked. "What is it?" "I can encase the entire shield world inside a slipspace enclosure. That's how we originally preserved it for millennia." "And that would keep Onyx safe from Cortana?" "Certainly. It would not, of course, remove the Guardian, but it would cut the construct off from Cortana, or anyone else attempting to give it orders, at least until it was able to re-establish contact.
"What do you need to make that happen?" Bakar asked.
"Access to one of the many control terminals situated throughout the Shield world. The nearest one is in this building, in the operations center, where I placed it."
Molly started for the hatch right away. "I thought the UNSC built the school." Prone followed after, and the others fell into line behind it.
"I helped with the planning, and specifically with the technological architecture of this and other buildings here."
Molly opened the hatch and led the way down. Prone came right after her, using its tentacles to pull itself down the ladder. They found their way to the operations center, which was right next to the school's main office. Fortunately, the office was completely empty. Kasha must have been helping out somewhere else in the school. Perhaps she was even looking for them.
"Why haven't you put Onyx into a slipspace enclosure already?" Molly asked the Huragok as they entered the operations center.
A large room with a number of chairs arranged around a long table. A wide picture window looked out over the grassy entrance to the school, and a gigantic display occupied the opposite wall.
"Given the message we received last night, isn't the fact that a dormant guardian existed inside Onyx enough of a threat?"
"To whom?" Prone to Drift said, as it moved to a wide section of the table.
"According to the message, a guardian will only harm those who attack it.
It has not done any harm to the Shield world itself so far, only to the humans established here, and only after it was attacked."
The top of the table morphed at the touch of Prone's tentacles, and it suddenly became a control panel filled with glowing characters etched into glass-smooth shapes. It seemed specifically built for Huragok alone, and Molly couldn't make any sense of it. To her, Forerunner tech often seemed like magic. But she knew that was only because she didn't understand how it worked. Molly supposed that, as with a lot of human tech, she didn't need to know the details of its inner workings to be able to use it. Yet, even that analogy was weak, since Forerunner tech went way beyond anything humanity had produced. Prone deftly ran its tentacles across the display, doing what appeared to be a dozen different things at once. A video feed suddenly appeared in the wall, surprising all of them, before they realized that Prone had turned it on. The feed showed the Guardian towering over Trevelyan. It looked like an impassive angel hovering ominously above the city. From this angle, something about its sweeping lines and the vast difference in scale between it and everything around it seemed eerily beautiful. The Guardian sent a clear message to humanity from its creators. They were only insects in the face of such power. "Can you zoom in on that?" Kareem said. "Beneath the Guardian, I mean."
Prone to Drift flicked something with one of its tentacles, and the image on the screen changed to show the landing field on which Molly had first set foot inside Onyx. The shadow of the Guardian fell there, wide enough to blot out the sun for everyone who stood below it. Molly saw gunfire splashing off one of a squad of those Forerunner machines they'd seen earlier, who were blasting away with their energy weapons at UNSC soldiers off-screen. Seeing them up close was eerie. They looked and moved like humans, but had a highly advanced robotic architecture, impressively armored, and clearly designed for war.
"What are these, Prone?" Molly asked. "They are defensive armatures. Your people refer to them simply as Forerunner soldiers, and their purpose is to protect the Guardian upon its activation."
"Where did they come from?" Kareem asked. "It's like all of a sudden there are thousands of them, just appearing from out of thin air."
"You are correct. They do come from out of thin air," Prone said cryptically. "The Guardian uses translocation technology to draft them over from their hidden storage sites, sending them directly into the combat you see."
"Well, they're still fighting," Molly said. "It's been hours, and the UNSC is still trying to stop these things."
"Where are those shots coming from?"
Kareem pointed to weapons fire that came from a different direction.
"Can you pull back a bit?"
The view switched to show a completely different angle, covering the spaceport at a distance. It was a haunting sight. The Marines stood alone on the platform, only a handful at the very center,
The landing pad had been entirely overrun by Forerunner soldiers, and the Marines were under fire from every direction. Every time a barrage of bullets knocked down one of the armatures, it seemed that another two stepped up into its place in a never-ending supply.
"What are they doing?" Karim asked. "Those Marines don't have a chance of surviving out there, do they?"
"It is certainly a low probability," Prone to Drift said. "There are pockets of resistance throughout the city, much like this one. In a short time, much of Onyx's security personnel will be either incapacitated or dead."
"We've got to do something to stop it," Molly said. "Quickly!"
"I am working as fast as I am able, Molly Patel. It is not an easy task."
"Did the Guardian take out the power in the entire S.H.I.E.L.D. world?" Gadam asked. "It's such a big place, you know, that it's hard to imagine that it could have affected everything."
"Most human activity in Onyx is centered in this region," Prone said. "By design, the Guardian's attack shut down everything inside of that."
"What about the researchers?" Molly said, thinking of her new parents. "Some of them worked pretty far out in the field. Maybe they were far enough away?"
"No researchers were outside of the attack's radius of effect." Molly's heart sank at Prone's report. "However, there was one Oni staff member who was on assignment at the time, and she was beyond the attack's range."
"Who?"
Molly's heartbeat quickened. "You know her. She is named Spartan Lucy B091. She took a single Pelican on a high-priority reconnaissance mission."
"That's right," Karim said. "She said she was going to investigate the portal leads, remember?"
"Not that it does us much good now." Gadam pointed to the screen. The armagers swarmed forward against the same group of Marines, who fell back against the assault.
"The Forerunner's tech seems to be working fine. What's one Pelican going to be able to do against that?"
"One Pelican and a Spartan," Molly corrected her.
"Wait a second," Karim said. "How are we seeing this, Prone? I mean, how did you get the screen in this room to turn on at all?"
"I fixed it. The pulse that the Guardian sent out shut down the power supplies for this entire region, but I set to repairing specific pieces right away. That is how I could check the school's sensors, and that is how I can access this terminal. Restoring the power to a single room is simple enough, but there are many rooms in Paxopolis, and many power sources."
"What about the cameras there? How are they working?"
"There are other Huragok inside Onyx, including two others at Trevelyan. I can only assume they repaired the cameras there, and I was able to link into them. They also spent a great deal of time repairing weaponry there that the Armagers have now destroyed."
"And you can also fix Onyx's slipspace controls too?" Molly asked.
"I have already done so. I only need to activate them to remove Onyx from real space."
"And that will cut off the Guardian from Cortana?"
"At least for a while. The Guardian is not without its own resources. I suspect that it would attempt to circumvent the dimensional problem and eventually be able to overcome my efforts and reestablish communications with Cortana."
"Then do it," Molly said. "Cut off its communication to Cortana now."
The others all nodded in agreement. Prone to Drift massaged the console with all of its tentacles at once. The cilia on the end of them moved so fast that they seemed to dissolve into a glowing blur. After a moment, it retracted one of its tentacles and used it to speak through the translator on its underside again.
"It is done. Observe."
The four youths stepped back to watch the scene at the spaceport again. The Guardian, which had been coursing with energy and power, still hovered there. But now it was inert and dead, completely frozen above the ground. A moment later, its wings, shoulders, and head slumped forward, and it remained that way, unmoving and seemingly dormant. Molly and the others cheered at the sight. Prone to Drift glowed a bit bluer than before, which Molly took to mean that it was pleased as well. As bad as this day's events had been till now, Molly finally started to hold out hope.
Chapter 27. The forward vanguard of the servants of the Abiding Truth raced through the streets of the Forerunner City, chasing after the Huragok.
Dural Mdama might have lost it in one of the twists and turns if it had not kept itself so high in the air to avoid being forced to navigate between structures. Yet, that it did not have to follow the streets meant it could move much faster than them, and the Sangheili could barely keep sight of it. Eventually, Dural and his vanguard